then to terrorists. That would only promote more terrorism. The FBI advised my mother and me that if we wanted to pay a ransom, the government would not stand in our way. That's true, we won't withhold basic administrative services, such as putting you in contact with local law enforcement agencies, but you will not have the support and approval of the U.S. government. More to the point, the State Department will not invite the Bureau to assist in any case abroad if the FBI negotiators intend to actively develop strategies that will facilitate the payment of a ransom. I can't believe that the State Department is keeping the FBI out. I assure you we're not. If the State Department hadn't insisted on strict compliance with an outdated policy, the FBI would have accepted your invitation to work on the case. That may well be the explanation given to you by a particular FBI agent, but the Bureau is fully aware of the U.S. policy against concessions to terrorists. If they're declining to get involved in the case, it's for their own reasons. Such as? Reasons other than a disagreement over policy. What possible justification could the FBI have for ducking a case involving a kidnapped American citizen? We can't force the FBI to get involved. We can only invite them. Theoretically, any number of things could lessen the Bureau's interest in a case abroad. Conflicts with local law enforcement, special dangers to FBI personnel, the identity of the victim. It was subtle, but he seemed to place emphasis on the last point. Are you suggesting that the FBI's declination has something to do with my father? He hesitated, as if he'd said too much. I was simply talking in hypotheticals. Is there something I should know? Perhaps you should ask the FBI. Perhaps, but why do I have the sense that you know something you're not telling me? Again he paused. Like I said, ask the FBI. Pressing for more would only have antagonized him. Thank you, I said. I definitely will ask them. As we hung up, I finally noticed the streams of cars speeding past me on the interstate. I'd been driving like my grandmother, not sure what to make of things. Mom and I had taken a liking to Agent Nettles at our initial meeting, but it seemed impossible to reconcile the excuse he'd given me last night with the explanation offered by the consular agent this morning. The FBI was not taking the case, but why? One way or the other, my own government was lying to me. It was only a matter of which agency. My head was pounding as I cut across the expressway and took the fast lane back to Miami. Chapter 6. Mom and I cooked dinner ourselves, even though her friends had brought over enough casseroles and covered dishes for her to kiss the Cuisinart goodbye forever. Those closest to our family felt as compelled as we did to do something, even if it was as simple as keeping our cupboard stocked. For Mom and me, cooking was something to do besides worry, a way to pretend that we could weather the crisis together and maintain a semblance of normalcy. Dinner was a delicious shrimp creole made with, you guessed it, shrimp from Ray's Seafood Company. They weren't the gigantic ones from deep, cold waters off Venezuela that made such beautiful shrimp cocktails, but they were of good size for the Mosquito Coast. They tasted so fresh, and as the son of a fisherman, I knew why. They were fresh frozen, which sounds like an oxymoron, but Americans eat far more fresh frozen seafood than they realize. Restaurant patrons in New York, Chicago, or Boston would never guess that when their snooty waiter assures them that today's snapper is fresh, he really means fresh frozen. As in fresh when it was caught, frozen in the boat on its way to the dock, thawed for processing at the plant, refrozen for shipment, thawed again when it was sold, and therefore fresh when it finally lands on a dinner plate. Unappetizing as all that sounds, if it weren't frozen at various stages of the long journey from Nicaragua to your plate, that delicious grilled whitefish drizzled with mango butter would taste like whale dung and smell even worse. Of course, Mom just picked at her dinner, wondering if Dad had anything to eat. Honestly, I hadn't seen her sit down and eat a real meal in almost a day and a half. "Any leads on Lindsay?" she asked. My sister was still missing, which by itself wasn't alarming. She traveled with no itinerary in pursuit of her journalistic pipe dream. With one member of the family kidnapped, however, It would have been nice to be able to account for her. This afternoon I spent an hour calling people I thought she might stay in touch with. Some of them seemed to think she was in Costa Rica, a couple others said in Guatemala. It's all hearsay. I just can't find anyone who's talked to her recently. Mom was about to say something, then slipped back into her thoughts, pushing her food around. The plate was still full. Mine was empty. You should eat something, I said.
I can't.
It won't do any good to starve yourself. This tomato sauce is kind of nauseating. As co-chef, I take serious exception.
Sorry, I'm just not hungry. I've been nibbling since 5 o'clock this morning.
I did seem to recall pre-dawn noises in the kitchen. It was all part of the screwed-up pattern. A little reading at midnight, letter writing till 2 a.m., house cleaning at 3, and organizing the closets at 4. Neither of us was sleeping well, but Mom was especially affected. She was accustomed to nights alone while Dad traveled for work. This time was different, however, her lying awake in the lonely king-size bed, wondering if that empty space beside her might be permanent.
"Have you talked to Jenna?" she asked.
That seemed out of the blue. Mom and I hadn't talked about her since I'd gotten back my engagement ring and washed a dollop of seagull droppings out of my hair. No, I haven't.
I noticed her name wasn't on your list of people to call.
That's because she's my ex-fiancée.
Don't be like that. She and your father were very fond of one another.
I know, but I'd rather just not deal with her right now.
Your father could use all the prayers he can get.
Mom certainly had a way of backing me into a corner. You're right, I'll drop her a line or something.
This ends Disc 1. A King's Ransom, Disc 2.
The phone rang as we were clearing the table. Mom answered, and her eyes lit up. It was Dad's Nicaraguan business partner, Guillermo, calling from Cartagena. He'd gone down to make funeral arrangements for the dead crewmen, arrange for transportation back to Nicaragua for the two they'd found alive so far, and generally to check on the company's newly acquired boats that were now riddled with bullet holes. I picked up the phone. Mom remained on the line in the kitchen. "Any news?" I asked. "Yes," he said with excitement. "Police have found one of them missing."
"Could it be Matthew?"
Mom shrieked. My heart was pounding right along with hers.
"No, no, it's Carlos, one of the welders who was missing, the third crewman."
I watched through the open doorway as Mom nearly collapsed in disappointment. I asked, "Is he okay?"
"Tired, but okay. These mosquitoes are unbelievable. He swam for hours and finally hid in some mangroves along the coast. He was there for almost 2 days, afraid to come out. Finally, he walked into town and found the police station."
"Does he have any information about Matthew?"
Mom asked.
"Yes, it's good news, I think."
"You think?" I asked tentatively.
"He saw the guerrillas pull Matthew from the water."
"Alive?"
"Yes, alive."
I glanced across the room toward Mom. She was sitting down, her elbow on the kitchen table, as she dabbed her eyes with a napkin.
"That's good," I said. "At least he's alive." "Yes, that part is good," he said.
I sensed there was bad news to go with it, and I worried whether Mom should hear it. Guillermo forged ahead without my encouragement.
"He says the guerrillas took Matthew away by boat. They were shouting, vowing to avenge the death of their friend with La Mina."
"What do you mean?"
"You know, the guerrilla who got shot and killed in the exchange of gunfire on the shrimp boat."
I understood that part. I meant, "La Mina, what's that?"
"Your father, the gold mine."
My heart sank. Apart from Dad's safety, that was my biggest fear, the kidnappers' inflated expectations.
"Have you talked to the Colombian police yet?"
I asked.
"Yes, that's where I am now. They are writing down Carlos's statement as we speak."
"Maybe I should fly down and speak to them myself."
"Probably not a good idea. From what the officer tells me, you will likely receive a communication from the kidnappers in the very near future. It wouldn't seem right to leave Kathy alone to handle that."
I took another glance toward the kitchen. Mom had the phone to her ear. I knew she was listening, but she was now too overcome to respond.
"You're right," I said. "I'll stay put. But let me talk with one of the officers on the case. I just want to introduce myself." "How's your Spanish?"
"Pretty good, not perfect."
"Hold on, let me try to find someone who can speak to you in English."
I heard muted conversations on the line, the sounds of a busy office in the background followed by a click. I saw that my mother had hung up. She was walking briskly toward the bedroom, another so-called allergy attack from which she'd emerge with red and puffy eyes. I felt a few pangs of pity for her, but they were mostly crowded out by my anger toward those murderers who dubbed my father a gold mine. A man came on the line, speaking English with a heavy Spanish accent.
"Hello, this is Officer Trujillo speaking."
"Thank you for taking the time to speak with me, officer. As you can imagine, my family is very concerned."
"Claro,"
he said, then caught himself and continued in English. It was about as good as my Spanish.
"I understand complete. Please know that we do everything possibly to bring your father safe. Judicial police has 1,200 officers working kidnap cases."
"That sounds very good."
"Si, he's very good. We all have much experience."
"Can you tell me anything about my father? Do you know if he's safe?"
"Not for sure, but it's muy importante to know most kidnaps in Colombia end with victims home safe to families. Ones who are shot are usually ones who try escape. Others are killed if trouble goes wrong when the kidnappers take the victim. Es muy bueno que we see no sign of fight at the kidnap of your father, and since he has 86 years of age, it's very not likely that he would try escape."
"What are you talking about? My father is 51. He did try to escape, and three people were killed during the botched abduction." There was silence on the line.
"You are Mr. Alvarez, no?"
"No. Nick Ray from Miami."
"My apologies, senor. Please understand, I have so many files."
The statistics from Agent Nettles suddenly flashed in my mind. More than 2,500 abductions a year, roughly 8 a day, one every 3 hours. No wonder this guy couldn't keep his cases straight.
"Forget it," I said. "I am so sorry. Do not have fear of my words," he said, backpedaling. "Not everyone who tries escape is shot."
"It's all right, really, but please keep my phone number in your file and call me with any news in the case." I gave him all my phone numbers, and as best I could tell, he was writing them down.
"I promise you will hear from me," he said.
"Thank you," I said, wondering if he would be calling me or the mysterious Mr. Alvarez. I hung up with mixed emotions. Dad was alive, or at least he'd been taken alive. But Officer Trujillo wasn't the first person to tell me that the stronger personalities, the people bold enough to try to escape, were the ones singled out for abuse, the ones kidnappers eventually discarded as more trouble than they were worth. That made me very afraid. My dad didn't have a submissive personality. I knew he'd try to escape at every turn. Mom knew it too. That was why she cried so often. I drew a deep breath, then walked to the bedroom to check on my mother. Chapter 7. The dawn of the third day was actually at sunset. Almost exactly 48 hours after the abduction, his blindfold finally came off. Matthew Ray shielded his eyes from the sudden burst of light, then staggered out of the back of the van, prodded from behind by the muzzle of an AK-47 assault rifle.
"Adelante!"
one of the guerrillas shouted. "Move it." Matthew said nothing, simply obeyed and kept walking. For 2 days he'd bounced and rolled on the cold metal floor of a speeding truck. Frequent sharp turns had slammed his head against the metal sides at least a dozen times, once nearly knocking him unconscious. Even by South American standards, the driving was breakneck, the roads were merely adequate, and both were deteriorating as the journey wore on. At first he'd tried to keep track of turns in hopes of discerning the direction of their travels, but after a dozen left turns, a half dozen right turns, and 2 or 3 trips around traffic circles, that proved impossible. The disorienting effect of the blindfold wasn't helping his sense of direction any. With his ear to the wheel well, he let the tires tell him this much. They'd moved from pavement to gravel to dirt to no roads at all. The normal sounds of city life had long since vanished. It had been at least 2 bathroom breaks since he'd heard another vehicle rumble past in either direction. That was quite a while ago. The driver obviously didn't have the bladder of a 50-year-old man. Matthew had traveled a good part of the trip with his legs crossed, and twice he'd barely made it to the side of the road to relieve himself without soiling his pants. With little to eat and drink, however, nature's callings turned less urgent. So far, his captors had allowed him one hard-boiled egg, one arepa, a soft drink, and a few sips of water. He would have been hungry if he weren't so concerned about more immediate causes of death. He wasn't gagged, and his feet weren't bound. He'd thought about yelling or kicking the sides of the truck to draw attention, especially during the early part of the journey while they were still in the city, but he'd read the U.S. State Department's travel advisories before leaving Nicaragua, and he'd followed the consular's official advice on how to behave when abducted in a foreign country. Kick and scream when in public, but once you're in the vehicle, quiet down and concentrate on surviving. You could end up beaten or drugged, or worse. Strange, but as yet he wasn't overly concerned for his own safety. He worried about Kathy and wondered how she'd handle this. Who would break the news to her? Would it come by telephone or would someone visit the house? Thankfully, Nick lived close by. This was going to be tough on the whole family, but it was hard to feel too sorry for himself. Hours of darkness behind the blindfold had forever etched in his memory the horrifying image of his friends, riddled with bullets, dead on the deck of the Niña as their blood ran together in a crimson pool. Hector and Ivan, two good guys in the wrong place with the wrong gringo at the wrong time. That was the scariest part for Matthew. He knew nothing about his captors except for one telling piece of information. With impunity, they killed the innocent. "Stop," said the guard. It was the first word of English that Matthew had heard since the abduction, but the commands quickly reverted to Spanish.
"Espera!"
Wait. Matthew was squinting. Even the twilight of early evening was more than his sensitive eyes could stand. The setting sun was a bright orange ball in a magenta sky that hovered above the jagged ridges of snow-capped mountains. There was a break in the clouds, and long golden rays streamed like lasers across the open valley. Suddenly the light was gone, and he was standing in the long shadow of two other gorillas. The first thing that impressed him was their weapons. Both were heavily armed, one with an AK-47 and two bandoliers of ammunition crisscrossing his chest, the other with an Israeli-made Galil assault rifle and a pair of grenades hooked to his belt. The second thing to strike Matthew was the obvious youth in their faces. They were barely teenagers. The stocky one motioned with his gun, directing Matthew to a fallen log at the side of the road.
"El baño," he said.
Peeing in the weeds was just something Matthew was going to have to get used to. Unescorted, he crossed the road and stopped at the log. The gorillas were still watching as he unzipped, though he wasn't sure why, except to further humiliate him. Finally, they turned away and shared a cigarette. They didn't seem overly concerned about his possible escape, probably because they were in the middle of nowhere. The dirt road they had traveled seemed to dissect an abandoned farm. Across the field, the dilapidated barn was barely standing. What was once a farmhouse had burned to its foundation so long ago that the remains were almost completely covered with weeds. Beyond were endless fields of some kind of crop. Sugarcane was what it looked like. That gave Matthew a start. From his last trip to Colombia more than 20 years ago, he remembered where most of the Colombian sugarcane was grown. "Good Lord, they've dragged me as far as Cali." That gave him insight into the identity of his captors. The areas south of Cali were guerrilla strongholds of various Marxist groups. He zipped his fly and glanced back at the guards. One was sitting in the truck with his hat over his eyes. The other was throwing stones at a fence post. Matthew took the moment of privacy to take stock of his possessions. Passport gone, wallet gone, ditto for his wristwatch. They'd left him with the clothes on his back and one essential that in these surroundings seemed like a luxury, his reading glasses. He didn't imagine he'd be doing much reading. These sons of bitches appeared to be the most desperate group of illiterates he'd ever encountered. Again he glanced at the guards. Now they were both seated in the van, their backs to their prisoner. Matthew took a good look across the valley. The tall sugarcane wasn't that far away. In an all-out sprint, he could reach it in 60 seconds, maybe less. It might take these stupid guards that long to notice he was gone. The downside, of course, was that he knew that these guys could shoot. Hector and Ivan were the no longer living proof of that. One more look. The guy in the hat was sound asleep. The other was fiddling with the van's radio. This was an opportunity. It might be his last opportunity. His heart was pounding, as if waiting for the brain to send the message. Run for it. Suddenly, out of the weeds, another gorilla rose, then two more. They were standing between Matthew and the sugarcane, just 10 yards away from him. They'd been hiding on their bellies, invisible in their camouflage fatigues. Had he run for it, he would have stepped right on them. The one in the middle came forward. He seemed a good bit older than the others, maybe 30. Matthew recognized the eyes from the shrimp boat. He was the leader, the one who'd sported the Australian-style hat, the one who had murdered Hector and Ivan. "You were thinking about it, weren't you?" he said in English. "What?" said Matthew. "You are going to run?" "No. You lie. I saw it in your eyes." Matthew glanced back at the two guards in the truck. They were standing, watching and smiling. They'd set him up. The whole incident had been a test to see if he'd try to escape. He stepped closer, then stopped, staring Matthew directly in the eye. "My name is Joaquin. You are a prisoner of war, and you are now my responsibility. You will never escape, so don't try." "Whose war?" "The people's." "Who are you? That is not your concern. What do you plan to do with me?" "We intend to treat you as you deserve to be treated. If you are good, we are good to you. If you are bad, your family will be negotiating not for your release, but for the return of your lifeless corpse for a proper burial. Do you understand me?" Matthew was silent for fear of what he might say in anger. The audacity of this common criminal with a so-called cause was more than he could stand. "Do you understand?" Joaquin said more pointedly. "I don't understand any of this. This is crazy. You and your whole idiotic group of teenage Rambos is crazy." Joaquin glared. "Don Matthew, your attitude is not good. You have already cost me one good man. You are quickly proving to be more trouble than you are worth." Matthew said nothing. Joaquin turned away, then said something in Spanish to the smaller guard that Matthew didn't quite hear. "Adelante," said the little one. Another surprise, the voice was a girl's. As commanded, he started walking back toward the truck, but she gave him a shove in the other direction, prodding him again with the AK-47. They walked through chest-high weeds until they came to a small clearing of softer grass with the cold black ashes of an extinguished campfire in the center. Two mules were tied to a tree, both bearing a mountain of gear and supplies. Beside them were two goats, a large black one and a smaller white one. "Stop," she said in Spanish. "On your knees, eyes forward." Slowly he knelt in the grass, his arms at his sides. He could sense she was standing behind him, but he didn't look. He felt vulnerable, defenseless, and now he regretted the insults he'd hurled at Joaquin. These losers had murdered his friends, but he'd have to hold his tongue. They'd kill him just as quickly, especially if he continued to antagonize their leader in front of his little band of juvenile delinquents. He braced himself for some kind of disciplinary action, possibly a beating. He heard footsteps behind, heavy boots coming swiftly toward him. He didn't look back. He just gritted his teeth, expecting a swift kick to the kidneys. Joaquin suddenly whisked past him, and stopped, a long serrated knife in hand. He got down on one knee and began to sharpen it on a rock, the grinding noise piercing Matthew's ears. When he finished, he held the blade at eye level, the metal glistening in the setting sun. Matthew could not tear his eyes away from the 8-inch blade. Then, in one swift motion, Joaquin wheeled, reached behind him, and grabbed the smaller goat by the throat. He pinned the animal on its back, jabbed the knife in its underbelly, and slit upward, tearing the ribs from the sternum. It screeched in utter agony, a sound unlike any Matthew had heard since his days in Vietnam. It convulsed and kicked, still alive, blood spewing onto the ground. Matthew could hear the last breaths sucking through the gaping wound, through the sliced lungs. Joaquin rose, unmoved by the horrific sounds of pain. He simply watched and listened as the animal's screeches gradually weakened, its life-ending throes losing their kick. The agony lasted a solid minute, and then Joaquin seemed bored. He unholstered his pistol and shot the dying goat in the head. Then he turned toward the prisoner. My God, is this the way I'm going to die? Matthew preferred to be shot, making a run for it, than to be mutilated by this butcher. His muscles tightened as Joaquin drew near. He was about to lash out, but he held back at the last instant, convincing himself in that tense moment that he was surely worth more alive than dead to Joaquin. Joaquin wiped the bloody knife on Matthew's shirt, one flat side and then the other. "Don't ever run from me," he said in a low, threatening tone. "I promise. Death will not come so quickly for you." Matthew glared at him, wishing he could just deck this monster. "Up!" ordered Joaquin. Matthew rose, saying nothing. So much for Joaquin's promise to treat him well. Matthew had the feeling it was only the first of many lies. Joaquin said, "What you said before is true. This is crazy. We are all crazy." Then he turned to his guerrillas and shouted, "Bienvenidos a la Colombia!" They laughed. It was a word play on Colombia that Matthew had seen before in newspapers with no exact translation, but he got the drift. Welcome to Crazyland. At Joaquin's command, one guerrilla took Matthew by the left arm, the other by the right, as they led him to the pack mules. Chapter 8. I had a bizarre dream that night. My family owned a gold mine. We agreed to pay the kidnappers a king's ransom for my father's release. It was delivered in a dump truck, tons of glittering gold dust. The guerrillas came with shovels and wheelbarrow. When the last of the mountain had been hauled away, the rebels released their hostage. Out from the jungle walked an 86-year-old man who was not my father. Frantic, I chased after the guerrillas and shouted at the top of my lungs that they'd made a terrible mistake. One of them finally stopped and turned, almost laughing as he answered in the exact voice of the Colombian police officer I'd spoken to on the phone last evening. "You are Señor Alvarez, no?" Some people find meaning in dreams. I usually dismissed the good ones as wishful thinking and the power of suggestion. The bad ones I chalked up to stress, anxiety, and the power of indigestion. This time I wasn't taking any chances. The next morning I drove to the Miami field office for a personal visit with the FBI. I arrived at 9:30, took the elevator to the second floor, and checked in with the receptionist who sat on the other side of the bulletproof glass. I told her my name and why I was there. "You want Agent Nettles, our legal liaison for international kidnappings?" "I've seen him already. I'd like to see his supervisor, please." "Do you have an appointment?" "No, but it's no exaggeration to say that this is a matter of life and death. Please, I really need to see someone with authority." She gave me a quick once-over, as if trying to determine whether I was a nutcase.
"I'll see who's available," she said.
"Thank you." I sat in the naugahyde chair and waited. Rising from the table beside me was a 3-foot-tall trophy from a regional softball league. On the wall were 2 plaques that bore the names of FBI agents who'd lost their lives in the line of duty. It was in chronological order. There seemed to be more in recent years, like everything else. More guns, more criminals, more dead FBI agents, more Americans kidnapped abroad. Finally, the door opened, and the receptionist called for me.
"Come with me, please."
She clipped a visitor's badge to my shirt, and I followed her down the brightly lit hall. We made several turns, then came to a larger room that was partitioned into smaller workstations by chest-high dividers. Dozens of agents and other personnel were busy in their pods, reviewing files, working at computer terminals, or talking on the telephone. Work here was done without the noise and confusion of police stations, where people always seemed to be shouting at each other or dodging some drunk who was about to vomit on their shoes. An FBI field office had an air of dignity, practically a church compared to the zoo in blue downtown. We stopped at a conference room. 3 walls were windowless. The 4th was completely glass and faced the interior workstations. Inside were 2 agents who rose from the table to greet me. The older one was Agent Sam Hewitt, a man about my dad's age. He had the same lines around his eyes as Dad did, too, not from years of squinting in the sun, I surmised, but from habitually narrowing his gaze with suspicion. The younger agent was Angela Pintero, a tall woman with olive skin and short brown hair styled into tight, efficient curls. We exchanged pleasantries and then took our seats, me across the table from the two of them. "Are you Agent Nettles' supervisor?" I asked Hewitt.
"Not directly, but I am a supervisory special agent, and I'm aware of the impasse between the Bureau and the State Department."
"Good, because I'm making it my business to break the impasse. Agent Nettles tried to help, but his hands were clearly tied. If you can't do better, I'd like to speak to your supervisor."
"I'm confident we can help."
"That's encouraging. Do you have anything specific in mind?"
"First, I propose to listen. You came to us, I presume. You have some thoughts of your own as to how we can solve the problem?"
Hewitt sat back with hands clasped behind his head. Pintero was poised to take notes. They seemed to operate the way Duncan and I did, the senior guy running the show, the other playing backup. "Here's the way I see it," I said. "The State Department insists that FBI negotiators can't be involved if they plan to assist the family in the payment of a ransom. After speaking with my father's business partner last night, my fear is that the kidnappers will demand a ransom that my family can't possibly pay. If that's the case, we might as well have the FBI negotiators on our side trying to get the kidnappers to release my father for no ransom. Let's just tell the State Department we'll play by their rules." He smiled thinly as if amused.
"That's a little transparent, don't you think?"
"How so?"
"If I were the State Department, I would suspect that your overall plan is simply to get the FBI involved, get them entrenched in the case, and then ultimately ignore the no-concessions policy and pay a ransom."
The guy was onto me. "Do you have a better suggestion?"
"Yes. Take a step back and ask yourself why the FBI really declined the State Department's invitation to participate in this case."
I didn't like his tone. Things had suddenly moved from a friendly discussion to a subtle confrontation, one I didn't fully understand.
"You're going to have to help me out there, Mr. Hewitt.
Did you know that your father has been stopped and interrogated by U.S. Customs 19 times in the last 5 years?
That one hit me like ice water.
"No. Does it surprise you?"
"Not really. He probably fits an arbitrary profile the government has developed. As often as he travels alone between Miami and Central America, it honestly surprises me that he hasn't been stopped more often." They just stared at me, silent accusers. Their gaze made me look away through the conference room's glass wall. At one of the workstations outside the conference room, I noticed a bumper sticker tacked up on the bulletin board. It read, "So many Colombians, so little time."
"Am I in the narcotics unit?" I asked.
"Yes, I'm a squad leader."
"My father's been kidnapped. Why am I talking to narcotics agents?"
"Because we're the ones you need to play ball with."
"What?"
"You give us something, we give you something. Quid pro quo."
"You'd better mean squid pro quo, because that's about all the Ray family can give you. My father's a fisherman."
"Fisherman, huh?"
"Yeah, fisherman.
Whatever you say. But if you stick to that story, we get nowhere in our efforts to resolve the so-called policy differences between the FBI and the State Department."
I leaned into the table and looked him in the eye. "Let me make sure I understand. You're telling me that this deadlock between the FBI and the State Department can be cleared up if...
what? If you cut the crap about your old man being a fisherman."
"But that's what he is."
"Humor us," said Hewitt. "For argument's sake, let's say he's not."
I was getting angry. "Okay, let's play fantasy world. My dad's not a fisherman. Then what? You're saying that the FBI will help him get released from his kidnappers, but only if I give you information that will land him in jail the minute he returns to the United States? That's crazy."
"We're not after your old man. It's his business partner we want, the Nicaraguan, Guillermo Cruz."
"I barely even know Guillermo."
"That's our point.
said the female agent, her only contribution. I looked at her, then at Hewitt. Both were deadpan. There was nothing I could say in Guillermo's defense. I'd met him only once in my life. Hewitt said,
"Talk to your mother, see how much she knows. If you can come up with something compelling on Cruz, we're in business. We get the man we want, your father gets an FBI negotiator working on his case. Your whole family can have immunity from prosecution."
"Prosecution for what?"
"Talk to your mother, and take my advice. Watch yourself around Guillermo Cruz."
They rose simultaneously as if on cue. It struck me as pure intimidation, the strategic moment at which an experienced agent like Hewitt liked to end meetings of this sort. The younger agent opened the door to escort me back to the lobby. As she led me away from the table, I stopped for one last word with Hewitt.
"Just out of curiosity," I said, "of all those times my father was stopped by U.S. Customs, how many times was he found to have broken the law?"
He said nothing.
"That's what I thought."
I turned and headed out the door, the other agent at my side.
"Kid,"
said Hewitt. I was halfway down the hall with Agent Pintero. We stopped and looked back.
"It only takes once,"
he said flatly, then stepped back into the conference room. I wondered if that was some kind of warning that he'd continue to dog my family until he got something on us. Or was he implying that he already had the goods? I continued toward the lobby in silence, more confused than when I'd arrived. Chapter 9. Notice of death, were the three words that caught my attention. Alone at my desk, I read the caption on the pleading twice to make sense of it. After the meeting with Agent Hewitt, I'd driven straight down I-95 to my law firm. I quickly dismissed the idea of asking Duncan Fitz for advice on how to handle the government's accusations. My supervising partner would have been utterly unamused to hear that my father and his business partner were on the FBI's radar screen. Nevertheless, I rode up the elevator and went straight to my office, with no real purpose other than to be alone there. As my ex-fiancée had finally come to realize, my career was my cocoon. Bad news, a crisis of any sort, retreating to my cubbyhole and immersing myself in work could make just about anything seem to disappear. Countless times, Jenna had begged me to crawl out of my cave and talk out a problem with her. Eventually, I would emerge, usually with the proud announcement that I'd figured out everything by myself and that there was nothing left to talk about. It used to make her crazy. And here I was again, going through my stack of mail as if that would fix everything with the FBI. It wouldn't, of course. And what made the whole exercise even more absurd was that I didn't even need to be there. Duncan had arranged for another associate to review my mail while I was on personal leave for the week. Anything that was deemed bland enough to remain in my inbox until my return was about as compelling as reading the phone book, with the exception of the latest pleading filed by the plaintiff's counsel in the Medfam Pharmaceuticals case. A simple one-page notice of death advised the court of the sad turn of events. Gilbert Jones was dead. He had died of respiratory failure the morning after Duncan talked him into playing Let's Make a Deal. We all knew he was going to die. No one expected it to happen this soon. He'd given up. Duncan had snatched away what little he had left to fight for in his life. Having met Gilbert, I felt bad enough. Dad's being kidnapped made me feel that much worse. Gilbert's death made me realize that everyone had a breaking point, maybe not the stomach to pull the trigger or jump off a bridge, but certainly the ability to act, or more precisely, not act, on the realization that there was no escape and that pushing forward was utterly pointless. That Gilbert had reached his point of despair so soon after Duncan's ploy made me terribly depressed. The thought that Dad might someday follow had me downright distressed. Even the strong could snap at the hands of abusive kidnappers. I pushed the mail aside. Being alone wasn't the answer. I needed to talk to someone. I wasn't exactly sure why, but I found myself dialing Jenna's phone number. My mother had planted the seed in my head yesterday when she'd suggested that I tell her about the kidnapping. It had sounded like a bad idea then, and in some ways it didn't sound any better now. I was down in the dumps, however, and for some reason I wanted to hear her voice. "Hello?" she answered. I almost hung up, but I knew that her cell phone had caller ID. She'd think I was stalking her. "Hi. It's me, Nick." "I know. I recognize the number. How are you?" "I have some bad news, I'm afraid." "Your dad, I know. I'm sorry."
"You heard?"
"I saw Duncan Fitz at the courthouse yesterday. He told me." Jenna was a trial lawyer at a small firm in Coral Gables. As she used to rub it in, lawyers at smaller firms actually had their own cases and got to see the inside of the courthouse, unlike the young paper pushers at law firms like Cool Cash. "Well, I'm glad he mentioned it," I said. "I wanted you to know." "I wasn't sure if I should call you or not. I wrote a little personal note to your mom. I know this might sound hollow, but if there's anything I can do, just call. I mean it. I feel terrible that this has happened."
"Thanks."
"You're welcome." I paused, not sure where to take it from there. We'd been best friends and lovers for almost 5 years. How weird it was to think that if my father hadn't been kidnapped, we might never have uttered another word to one another. My heart was pounding. I was nervous and confused. I felt guilty, too, thinking that in some way I'd used my father's crisis as an excuse to reconnect with Jenna, however briefly. Calling her had accomplished nothing, or maybe it had proved too much. The mere sound of her voice had only confirmed that I wasn't over her. "So, how are you doing?" I asked. She said something beyond good, but it was garbled. The connection was breaking up. "I'm sorry, what?" I said. Her response was pure static. The connection was even worse. "I think I'm losing you." As soon as I'd said it, the line went dead, and I realized the irony of my words. I placed the receiver in the cradle, sat back in my chair, and stared blankly off to the middle distance. "I've definitely lost you," I said softly. My cell phone rang. I snatched it from my pocket, thinking it was Jenna. It was my mother.
"Good news," she said.
"What?"
"I've been worried sick ever since Guillermo told us how those kidnappers think of your father as a gold mine. All I've been able to think is, what if we can't pay the ransom?"
"I know, we're all worried."
"Well, our worries are over."
"What do you mean?"
"If we have to, we can pay a gold mine and then some."
"How?"
"Your father once told me that if anything ever happened to him on one of his trips, I should check a special safe deposit box he opened at Brickell Trust. The last couple of days I've been putting it off. I was afraid I would find a letter of goodbye or something on that order. This morning I finally went. You won't believe what was in there."
"Stop right there, Mom." On the heels of Agent Hewitt's accusations, I was suddenly concerned that Mom and I might not be the only ones on this phone line.
"But this is really good news.
We'll talk about it when I get home. I'll be right there." I hung up before she could say more. I had no idea what she'd found, but I surely didn't want her blurting it out if there was any possibility that the FBI had tapped our lines and was eavesdropping. I returned the notice of Gilbert Jones's death to the top of my pile, then quickly headed out the door. Chapter 10. As a lawyer, I was embarrassed to admit it. But I couldn't lie to my own mother. I'd never heard of kidnap and ransom insurance for a fisherman. That was exactly what Mom had found in the safe deposit box, a K&R insurance policy issued to my father. I'd seen that type of coverage before, but only for the big multinational conglomerates. For companies with employees abroad, it certainly made sense to shift the risk of an abduction to an insurance company. The insurer was then on the hook for paying the ransom and, even more important, hiring a private security consultant to negotiate a safe release. When I thought about it, the concept made even more sense for a small business. A $500,000 ransom would do much more damage to Ray's seafood company than would a $10 million hit to a Fortune 500 company. Until now, however,
I'd never realized how affordable it was, even for the little guy. I read the entire policy carefully, first page to last, while seated at the kitchen table with my mother looking over my shoulder. I was at once proud of my old man for thinking of it and excited as hell that he'd actually followed through and bought it. Hot damn, Dad was insured.
"This is good, right?" said Mom.
"It's fantastic."
"So I read it correctly? The insurance company pays the ransom?"
"Up to $3 million."
Her eyes brightened, and she actually smiled. It was the most upbeat I'd seen her. "I wish your father had told me he had insurance. Why was he so secretive with the safe deposit box?"
"It says right here in the policy that if the insured tells anyone that he has kidnap and ransom insurance, the policy is void. Apparently, Dad took that pretty literally. He wouldn't even tell you."
"What happens now?"
"I'll call the insurance company and give them notice. If I read the policy right, they select the negotiator who will handle Dad's case."
"Is that better than using the FBI?
I hesitated to tell her about the disastrous meeting with Agent Hewitt. Her spirits were too high. "My guess is that these private consultants are former FBI hostage negotiators and the like. How can it get better than that? We'll have a skilled negotiator who doesn't have to work within the box created by bureaucrats and diplomats."
"If only I'd gone to the bank sooner, but when your father told me to check the safe deposit box if anything ever happened to him, I thought he meant if he crashed in one of those little airplanes they fly into Puerto Cabezas or was lost at sea in a leaky old shrimp boat. I was so afraid to find something in the box that I wasn't ready to see a last will and testament or..."
"I understand."
"Please be firm with this insurance company. You know how slow they can be."
I could hear the concern in her voice, her fear that she'd needlessly delayed things by not finding the policy sooner. "Mom, I don't care what it takes. Before the day's over, I'll speak to our negotiator, I promise." As it turned out, keeping that promise proved almost too easy. Dad was insured with Quality Insurance Company, a Bermuda-based subsidiary of a worldwide underwriting group. More important, I quickly learned that Quality was a client of Coolidge, Harding, and Cash. The connection wasn't surprising. While scores of companies offered kidnap and ransom insurance, the leaders in the industry and the ones who had pioneered the concept were the largest insurers in the world. Companies like that were the mainstay of the Cool Cash client roster. The Miami office had never done work for Quality Insurance, but a woman in our New York office was their go-to lawyer in the United States. She was only too glad to help, which underscored the wisdom of my earlier decision to run a conflict check at my firm before placing a phone call to Quality. Having represented insurance companies myself, I'd anticipated needing to be aggressive, perhaps even a little nasty, to make the elephant jump. However, I recalled a fellow associate in our office who, on a purely personal matter, had written an ugly letter to an appliance discount store on Cool Cash letterhead. The scathing missive eventually landed on the desk of the partner in our Atlanta office who happened to represent that, quote, sleazebag, bait-and-switch, two-bit operation, end of quote. 2 weeks later, my friend was working in the county attorney's office. I learned from his mistake. Instead of being in the defensive posture of explaining to a New York partner why I was beating up on her client, I had the partner working for me from the get-go. She personally followed through to make sure the case was assigned immediately to a Miami consulting firm, and Duncan Fitz offered to sit through our first meeting in his office just to make sure that Quality Insurance understood that this law firm had a keen interest in the case. Thank God for small favors. Twice for big ones. This was huge.
"Alex Cabrera is here," Duncan's secretary announced over the intercom.
"Send him in," said Duncan. Duncan and I rose as the door opened, both of us surprised to see that Alex was a her, not a him. I'd expected someone like Agent Nettles, but in walked a striking Latina woman with big brown eyes. She was dressed in a fitted gray business suit that was conservative only in color, as it did little to hide the fact that she took very good care of her body. I probably looked a split second longer than I should have. Any man would have done the same, and notwithstanding the 1-2 punch of Jenna and her dive-bombing seagull on the beach, I was, after all, still a man. Alexandra Cabrera, she said. Call me Alex.
My pleasure, I said as we shook hands.
I'm with Crowell Associates.
A fine organization, said Duncan. I've used your investigators for litigation support.
He glanced at me and added, they're one of the largest private investigative and security firms in the world. Actually, you're thinking of Crowell Associates. I said Crowell. She spelled it.
Oh, sorry.
A lot of firms in this business have similar-sounding names. It gets confusing.
So you're based here in Miami?
I asked. For the past 2 years. I spent 7 years doing the same kind of work in Bogota.
Well, you come very highly recommended by our partner in New York. She says you're an expert on kidnapping and business extortion.
Solving and preventing it, she said, not committing it. We shared a little smile over her joke, and then she turned serious. I'm very sorry about your father, but you've come to the right place for help. Duncan's secretary brought us fresh coffee. We took our seats, Duncan behind his desk, Alex and I in the wing chairs that faced him.
Where do we begin? I said.
I want to hear your whole story, but I should tell you a little about myself, just so you know you're not wasting your breath. I was born in Bogota. My mother was Colombian, and I'm told my father was from Italy. I won't burden you with the details of my childhood, but suffice it to say I grew up very fast. By the time I was a young teenager, I was already caught up in anti-government activities. At age 16, I joined Las Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia, FARC for short.
That might be the group that has my father.
It's one of the largest and last remaining Marxist guerrilla armies on Earth. More to the point, it's probably the biggest kidnapping enterprise that has ever existed. FARC and organizations like it account for over 60% of the kidnappings in Colombia.
That's a lot of kidnappings.
You have no idea. The more you analyze the numbers, the more ridiculous they seem. 1 out of every 5 kidnappings for ransom in the entire world happens in Colombia.
How long were you with FARC? I asked.
Less than 2 years. Long enough to learn the kidnapping trade.
Duncan said, I don't suppose you'd find many FBI stiffs with those kind of credentials.
You won't find any, said Alex. I once thought of applying to the FBI, but with my past connection to FARC, I was told not to bother. It's their loss. My other life is exactly the reason I can help you in ways they can't.
Don't be offended, I said, but I have to be honest. I was expecting my negotiator to be a former law enforcement officer, not a former member of FARC.
First of all, I was 16 years old when I left FARC. Second, you won't find a former FBI agent or Scotland Yard negotiator with more experience in Colombia or a better success record than mine.
Have you negotiated the release of an American before? Asked Duncan.
Yes, and some Canadians as well. But if you're thinking it's any easier to negotiate for the release of a Colombian, you're wrong. Generally, these aren't politically motivated kidnappings, they're financially motivated. The nationality of the victim is relevant, if at all, only to the extent that it might affect the amount of ransom demanded.
You certainly seem to know your stuff, I said.
The most important thing is that you have confidence in your negotiator. Under your father's policy, the insurance company pays for a private consultant only if you use Crowell Associates. But if you don't like the specific consultant assigned to your case, you're not stuck. There are others in our organization to choose from. For example, we have a former CIA agent who's a crackerjack on Mexico. I'm sure he'd do a fine job in Colombia, much the way one of your bankruptcy lawyers would do just fine on a divorce case.
I get your point, I said.
You can also bypass private security altogether and rely on the FBI.
That's not really an option. I'm at an impasse with them.
I didn't elaborate in front of Duncan. The threat from the narcotics agents was best kept to myself. I'm sorry you had that experience, she said. There are a lot of talented negotiators in the FBI who can be of tremendous help to families when the bureaucracy lets them do their job.
It's pretty clear the bureaucracy's winning this battle.
That's one of the benefits of private security. I'm totally responsive to you and to you only. My approach is to tell you everything, each step of the way. I'll advise you of what to do, explain to you the significance of every little thing the kidnappers do, and offer my best guess as to what they might do in the future.
Total honesty and openness is the best approach, as in any other relationship. And believe me, this is a relationship.
Not too long-term, I hope.
She didn't smile. Didn't the FBI even tell you that much?
What?
The length of time it normally takes to bring a Colombian kidnapping case to closure.
He wanted to wait and see who was involved before making any projections.
That makes some sense, but you should be forewarned.
Of what? I asked.
These guerrilla organizations don't exactly operate at breakneck speed.
How long might it take? Weeks? Months?
I've had a few relatively quick resolutions, but for the most part, we're definitely talking months.
How many?
The average case, anywhere from 6 to 12.
A fucking year?
My astonishment was met with plaintive silence. I warned you, I don't sugarcoat.
I prefer it that way. Excuse my profanity.
No problem. You'll hear worse from me before this case is over, assuming you want me on the case.
I shot a quick glance at Duncan. He seemed to be as impressed as I was.
Absolutely, I said. Great. Now, it's been very nice meeting you and Duncan, but I'd like to meet with you and the rest of your family as soon as possible.
My sister's traveling, and we haven't been in touch with her yet, but I can drive you over to my mother's house right now.
Let's go.
We rose to leave, but Duncan stole another minute of Alex's time. He needed surveillance work for one of his cases and wanted to know if Alex had any suggestions. Right. Ever since his divorce, Duncan seemed to draw personal validation from any attractive woman who would smile and talk to him, even if it was purely business from her standpoint. I waited at the window and looked down 30 stories on the evening rush hour traffic. It was slowly snaking south on busy Brickell Avenue, an endless chain of fuzzy orange taillights at dusk. People were going home, the same old routine, not knowing how lucky they were to have their routines. Could this possibly drag on for a year? So much in a person's life could change in that much time. Look at me and Jenna, engaged 1 month, history the next. Could my father physically survive that long in some remote guerrilla camp? He'd survived Vietnam, albeit as a much younger man. What would the emotional scars be like, the effects of prolonged captivity? Not seeing him for that long was unfathomable. Poor Mom, I thought. The reality sinking in. Poor Dad.
Chapter 11.
For only the second time in my life, I was taking a woman home to meet my mother and desperately wanted them to hit it off. Obviously, the circumstances were very different, as were my motivations. Yet I was strangely reminded of Jenna as Alex and I wove through traffic in my Jeep with the canvas top down. It was a rare, comfortable evening in early autumn, without the persistent mugginess that usually lingered in South Florida until almost Halloween. Alex had removed her jacket and pulled her shoulder-length hair back to keep it from blowing in the breeze. Her profile was classic. Whether she was the more beautiful was hard to say, but no slight to Jenna, she was definitely more intriguing.
So how'd you get caught up in FARC?
We were stopped at a traffic light on Coral Way. Just ahead was the world's first Burger King restaurant. Decades later, it was still there, but everything around it had changed as the new Miami took over the old Miami. Miami, my grandmother used to call it, an era as extinct now as the old notion of a healthy suntan. To my left was the original Latin American cafeteria, where people waited in line outside for a chance to sit at the long, horseshoe-shaped counter and order everything from medianoche sandwiches to milkshakes made with exotic fruits like mamey. At the walk-up café across the street stood a group of Spanish-speaking men dressed in guayaberas, traditional Cuban shirts. Espresso, served in little plastic cups, inspired friendly arguments over baseball and politicians who were too soft on Castro. Just ahead, the man in the intersection with the big straw hat was hawking bags of limas from the tree in his neighbor's backyard. It was the Miami I'd grown up with, the cultural mix I liked.
Alex said, "I wouldn't say I was caught up in FARC. I just joined."
"Why?"
The usual burning philosophical issues that propel teenage girls to do anything.
Meaning what?
My boyfriend was in it.
I suppose we've all been there on some level, except that the craziest thing I ever did was sign up for the Glee Club.
Not sure which of us was the bigger sucker.
True. I got dumped about 2 weeks after I signed up. How about you?
That's about the size of it.
Did he meet someone else?
No, he took a bullet in the head.
For a second, I felt like I'd taken the bullet. I'm sorry.
Don't be. He was a drug-addicted, worthless piece of trash who didn't think twice about kidnapping people like your father.
Did he ever kill anyone?
Yes. I hesitated, then asked,
"Did you?"
"Why do you want to know?"
"Just thought it might come up with my mother. You know, the natural progression of things. Hello, how are you? Ever been a revolutionary?"
She smiled cryptically. "Would it make a difference to you if I had?"
I wasn't sure it would, but I was beginning to wish I hadn't asked. "I suppose not. Like you said in Duncan's office, that was your other life."
"Exactly." The light turned green, and we were flowing with the traffic again. I waited for her to elaborate, but after several moments of silence, it was clear that she wasn't about to. Fark was her other life, that was that. Maybe she had killed someone. Maybe she hadn't. Just don't piss her off, Nick.
"Tell me about your father," she said. "What's he like?"